Drive Time on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Zurich. We believe small actions can have great impact. Take a small action today. Speak to a financial broker about a Zurich pension.
The state's climate action plan has finally been published, as I said, at the very top. It's called Securing Our Future. €125 billion. That's the estimated cost of halving Ireland's greenhouse gas emissions by the end of this decade. For weeks now, speculation has focused on exactly how much each sector of the economy will have to cut. Well, we'll have to wait a little bit longer for those details, I can tell you. Specific emissions reduction ceilings won't be announced until next year. Either way, though, the biggest emissions cut will come from energy, specifically from electricity, which will see 80% of the country's power coming from renewables by 2030. Agriculture, a huge focus of debate and lobbying in this programme and others, will have to find cuts of between 22% and 30%. The range is narrower there. The plan does not discuss changes to animal numbers, but suggests that reduction in the number of chemical fertilisers will achieve most of farming's reduction. Now, within the past half an hour, the Taoiseach Micheál Martin has told a news conference that every aspect of life in Ireland will have to change, he said, as we aim for carbon neutrality.
I recognise that the transition to climate neutrality, no later than 2050, will require a profound change in the practices and sectors that support our lifestyle. Our homes, workplaces, communities must all adapt, but the benefits to all of us and future generations are clear. In terms of our public health and our overall quality of life, the plan we are publishing today has the potential to be truly transformative. For some, it will be difficult. But the simple truth is that if we delay any further, we will face greater costs and be able to seize fewer opportunities.
And that is the Taoiseach Micheál Martin of Fianna Fáil speaking moments ago. The Taoiseach Leo Varadkar pointed out that these reductions were needed because Ireland's per capita emissions are among the highest in the world, he said.
Ireland is a small country. We're only 5 million people. But on a per capita basis, we've had a disproportionately large impact on our climate. Divide the amount of CO2 gases that we produce every year by our population of 5 million, and you'll find that we're one of the highest in the world when it comes to producing and releasing greenhouse gases into our environment. And that's been the case for quite some time. So before we have the moral authority to ask others to do more, we need to do a lot more ourselves.
It's the 4th of November 2021, and isn't it interesting in the traffic and travel news that a lot of our roads are still chock-a-block with cars, petrol and diesel cars. I wonder how much longer, because as you heard in the bulletin, the government has been unveiling its climate action plan, and that launch, I see, is still ongoing. It's a huge plan and it will affect you whether you like it or not. Later in the programme, we'll speak to a government minister and to Sinn Féin as well about the plan. But first, with their initial analysis, I'm joined by three experts who've been looking at specific provisions in key parts of the plan. And they are Dr. Rory Monaghan, who lectures in energy engineering at INUI Galway, Professor Sive O'Neill, who lectures in climate policy and environmental politics at DCU, and Dr. Brian Caulfield, Assistant Professor in Civil Engineering at Trinity College, Dublin. Thank you both. Thank you, the three of you, for looking at transport and agriculture and energy for us and lending us your expertise. Brian, I might start with you. First of all, a sector most of us use every day in some capacity or other, transport. Now, this plan calls for 500,000 daily journeys to be made by walking, cycling or public transport. Now, you might tell us, how does the government propose to get us out of cars?
Looking at the plan, the way that they're going to do this is by investing in public transport. A lot of the investments have already been announced on that, as well with walking and cycling. So they seem to be the main ways in which they're going to get us out of the car. Having only seen it for the past 40 minutes or so, I don't see an awful lot in there about working from home just yet. But that is another way, I suspect, that they'll achieve those goals.
Is it achievable, I wonder, in your opinion?
It's very ambitious, and we need ambition now more than ever. There's 71 actions in there, and you know, you couldn't argue with any of them. You can finesse some of the points around perhaps electric vehicles, which I'm happy to talk about, but you can't say that there is an ambition there. How realistic it is, I'm not sure.
Okay. Well,
one of the other things...
Sorry, I was just going to ask listeners, if you think, if you're commuting right now and if you can safely text us 51551, even with an enhanced public transport system, could you commute to work without using your private car? You were going to say, Brian?
I was going to say one of the things that was kind of striking in it, specifically in the transport chapter, was the word rural is only mentioned five times in 15 pages, and that's where a large amount of our emissions are. So I would have expected to see a little bit more focus there. And one of the things I've been calling for a while now is that there will be some sort of an enhanced grant for people living in rural areas for the electrification of their cars when they don't have the public transport alternative that are in the urban parts of the country.
Which is amazing, isn't it? Because the plan sets a target of nearly a million electric vehicles on our roads. Is that realistic in your opinion?
It kind of fudges it. It doesn't say fully electric vehicles. It says electric vehicles, which also includes plug-in hybrids. And from my perspective, they should be taken out of it. And the government has started to do that by you know, taking away the incentives around that. How realistic it is on purely electric vehicles, I'm not sure. There's very little in there either on, you know, the charging networks that are going to be required. But one of the big gaping holes on the logistics of actually doing this is around parking. Where do these cars park to be charged? In the greater Dublin area, which is almost 1.5 million people, only 44% of people in that area have a driveway to park one of these cars. So that's a huge issue. And that's another thing that will hamper the ambition that's there around electric cars.
Okay, and before I finish with you, Brian, people don't want to see a double standard here. And a number of commentators already have said the Dáil car park has to go. You can't ask the public to do one thing, use public transport, and have TDs driving right into the city centre in Dublin in their private cars. Would you agree with that in any way?
I would fully agree with that. In fact, I signed the petition that went into the Dáil to have that car park removed and rewild the front of Leinster House. Yes, you know, we're being told by, you know, all of the ministers and the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach today that this is going to be difficult. But this difficulty should be, you know, should be spread around.
Okay.
And everybody should feel it.
Okay, very interesting. Dr. Brian Caulfield of Trinity College Dublin, thank you very much indeed for your expertise on transport. Let me talk now to Professor Sive O'Neill from DCU. We're going to talk about agriculture, Professor O'Neill. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. The plan says they want to reduce emissions by 20-30%, isn't that right, in agriculture? You might tell us how they propose to do that.
Well, firstly, I just want to say that this is very welcome. We've been looking forward to this day for a long time. And I, for one, and I think I probably speak for many people who've been tracking climate policy and who understand the urgency, don't want the government to fail. We need to see a broad consensus for climate action across the whole of society. And unfortunately, as you know, there's a lot of disagreement around the role of agriculture. So it's essential that we keep farmers on board and include them in all the decisions. And the reason I'm saying that is just by way of saying, unfortunately, I don't see significant policy changes here that will guarantee that we meet the 2030 target. There are lots of existing measures that are kind of ramped up, but it's generally the same old situation where the agricultural sector is slouching reluctantly towards climate action. And I'll just give you a couple of examples. The Climate Action Plan endorses the existing approaches under the Food Vision Plan and Ag Climatise. And, you know, it seems to envision a situation where we can continue to support an export-led commodification model and that we can achieve a sustainable agricultural system without having to fundamentally change our livestock
because
model.
I suppose what perturbs you a little bit, and I'm just guessing here, is that they're talking about managing the total herd number. There's no talk, is there, of reducing the amount of cattle in the country?
There's no mention of that at all. Now, in fairness, the measures, if you had stringent measures that manage the inputs of nitrogen or control the outputs, say in the case of milk or beef, you would eventually see a reduction in herd numbers. So that is true in a sense. But I think by approaching the issue of livestock numbers so indirectly, we're failing to communicate clearly to the sector that there are limits, that there are kind of ecological limits to production, mm-hmm. that stocking rates have to change and that nitrogen inputs have to come down dramatically.
Okay.
Now, I'll just mention a couple of the measures that
are good, actually,
because in fairness, there are good things here. So there are lots of policies around ramping up measures that were already there but haven't yet really kicked in terms of ag climate ties and also reducing nitrogen fertilisers from their current rate of about 400,000 tonnes per annum. So that's significant and that will make a difference to water quality. They're talking about setting up a fertiliser registry so we know who's doing what where, and that will be very important for regulating fertiliser inputs in the future. And I think one of the most dramatic positive areas is the plan to increase the area under organic production from 75,000 hectares to 350,000 hectares by 2030.
That's almost a fivefold increase, isn't
it? Yeah, it's very dramatic. But what I wonder is how will farmers be incentivized to make that switch unless there are caps to production? So if we don't have a cap on nitrogen or herd numbers, if we don't have a tax on nitrogen inputs or a tax on greenhouse gas emissions, if we're relying on voluntary measures and technologies that haven't yet delivered, I just don't see why farmers will make the switch.
Otherwise, there has to be quite a stringent inspection regime as well.
That's true. Now, I haven't had a chance to read through the chapter, you know, in enough detail. There is some stuff there, all right, about knowledge transfer and research and so on. But, you know, you raise a very good question there about the need for inspection and enforcement.
Okay.
And there is talk, you know, of the need to perhaps install a kind of pollution regulation regime on a farm-by-farm basis. And we might ultimately have to go there. So some good, some bad. And just to say as well that there is a mention of, and this would be quite significant for the farming community themselves, of the role of farmers in producing energy through biomethane and also biomass. And this could be good or bad depending on how it's implemented, but we'll just have to see the detail.
Okay.
That
same with an awful lot of the sectors, it seems. Professor Sive O'Neill from DCU, thank you very much indeed for your hot take, as they say, on what's in it for agriculture. Let's move to energy now. Dr. Rory Monaghan of NUI Galway, you're looking at the electricity sector. This is one of the highest percentage cuts, isn't that right? Somewhere between 62 and 81% of a cut in emissions is what they want to achieve, somewhere in that range. How will they do it, do they say?
Yeah. Well, look, I guess I'm in a similar position to the other contributors there in that this only came out in the last hour or so. And I was actually in class and spent half the class with my students helping me go through this. So I'd like to give a shout out to the Energy Systems Engineering class.
Thank you to your class from Drive Time.
Yeah, exactly. But no, so like from going through this, it seems that they're looking at three basic levers in the electricity sector. The first one is to increase the overall electricity demand. So that means getting more electricity used in sectors where it's not currently used, like transportation, as Brian mentioned, and also in the heating sector. The reason for that is for lever two. Electricity has shown itself to be the easiest, or I guess the least difficult sector to decarbonize to date. We've currently got about 40% renewable electricity on our system in Ireland right now.
Mm-hmm.
And the plan is to increase that to averaged over the year 80%. Now, at some points in that in the year, we'll be producing far more than that 80%, and at some points we'll be producing far less, which leads to the third key lever that I see here, and that's flexible demand. And that's the ability for the network operator to take demand off the system when we're getting close to these periods that we're seeing now, these crunches between energy supply and energy demand.
Is there anything in it about data centres and how much electricity and energy they're sucking from the grid?
There's a lot about data centres in there. And actually, when you go to the actions At the end of the electricity section in this report, the very first one is data centers, reviewing the policy for large energy users. The projections, the modelling that's contributed to this piece of work is showing that there could be up to a quarter of electricity in Ireland coming from users like data centers. Mm-hmm. And so it will be really important to get these data centers on some sort of flexible demand. So when, you know, when supply is low, when overall demand is high, can these data centers generate their own power on site?
Dare I say it, maybe even pay into some of the grid and maybe produce some of their own electricity as well, which has been suggested in and is done in other countries.
Like looking at the electricity part of this study, you know, it's clear that the government has its work cut out, because there's a lot of in the actions, you know, they're recognizing that they need to make the plans before they can get moving on. Mm-hmm. On any of this. But it seems to me that there's lots of synergies here, that if the plans are developed in the right way, they could kill two birds with one stone.
Yeah.
So if we've got this variable renewables coming from wind off our coast, if we've got these big data centers that always need to be on, can we use can we store energy from these wind farms, either in batteries or in something like hydrogen, which is mentioned in this paper, to run those generators when there's no wind available?
Okay.
Lots of ways it could come in.
Can I ask you briefly before I let you go about Equinor, the Norwegian wind energy company, leaving the project they were involved in, the Irish market to create renewable energy off the Irish coast? Is that a bad start to the climate action plan announced today?
I guess, look, it's unfortunate timing that it was today. You know, there is an action in here about completing the marine. The marine action
planning bill. Yeah.
Yes. Now, obviously, it came too late for Equinor, but it's unfortunate. It's indicative of the level of change that we need to have in our planning system here. But, you know, Equinor was not the only company that's looking to develop offshore wind in Ireland. There's many projects underway off the east coast and the south that are going ahead.
Okay.
Okay,
well, that is the expert view. My thanks to Dr. Rory Monaghan. My thanks to Professor Sive O'Neill and to Dr. Brian Caulfield as well. That's the initial expert view. We'll talk to reps from government and opposition a little bit later on. What do you have to say? Well, a listener says the reality of travel in rural Ireland needs to be considered. Very, very difficult not to drive to work. Local Link are doing great, but not resourced enough. Need to offer a service before people can commit to shared transport. Likewise, need pathways. Too dangerous to walk. Why are they building new roads without pedestrian and cycle lanes? Says one listener. And one more. In regards to transport, I live one side of Waterford City and work on the other side. No bus service. I love cycling, but it's just too dangerous. I'd have to cycle across rush hour, Rice Bridge in rush hour traffic. A foot cycle bridge is being promised for about 6 years, which is still not started. So that says that listener. Keep your texts coming to 51551.
Tweet at DriveTimeRTE.
Now, as you've been hearing, the government published its climate action plan today. Launching the plan, Environment Minister Eamon Ryan of the Green Party responded to critics of Ireland's decision to take serious action now, while others shirk their responsibilities on climate change.
To those who question why we should act while other countries hold back, the obvious answer is, why should we miss out on this opportunity to change our country for the better? To those who question whether the ambition can be delivered, all we need to do is look at the changes we were able to make during this COVID period time. Having done everything to protect older generations during COVID, surely we can implement this practical and positive plan to give our young people a secure future and a stable planet on the beautiful island we have.
That's Minister Eamon Ryan. A short time ago, Taoiseach Micheál Martin denied that internal political squabbles over percentages would dominate the coming months and outlined how the precise cuts would be agreed within the Oireachtas.
First of all, it will not be a sectoral bun fight. I think already in terms of arriving at the ranges, the Minister for Climate, Minister Eamon Ryan, worked very constructively with the different ministers in respect of different sectors, and then also in the context of the Cabinet Subcommittee on Climate, undertook some significant deep dives into each sector. And so as we work through this, and there will be a finalisation and more specificity eventually in relation to the targets, but you know, we will, following the publication of the plan, the current plan gives effect to the carbon budgets. They're due to be passed by the Dáil early next year. Once the budgets are passed, these actions then will be tightened up, and then the specific sectoral emission ceilings will be finalised after those carbon budgets are passed by the Dáil.
It won't be a sectoral bun fight, says the Taoiseach, but we don't have the targets yet. Let's wait and see. But let's get a government take on these announcements now. Martin Hayden is Minister of State at the Department of Agriculture. He's with me now. Minister, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good evening, Cormac.
Are these aspirations, or can you give a commitment, you and the government, that they will be implemented in full, these actions outlined today?
Yeah, look, the action plan outlined today is part of a process that has been outlined there, you know, building on the carbon budgets and the overall sector targets that have been set by the Climate Change Advisory Council that still need to be adopted by the Oireachtas, and the ranges then that have been set out for the different sectors, you know, have been calculated and come to mindful of the type of approach that we need, where it is, you know, an ambitious plan, but also one where we're putting forward the least cost, highest benefit, most reasonable measure available to help
and
us.
And fully implementable, will they reach the target of a 51% reduction in emissions by the end of the decade?
You know, we have to reach that target, and we have to reach the target of net zero by 2050.
But will we know we have to. We have to do actually more than this, but will we reach that target set out today?
Yes, I do. I believe we will. Because there's a determination there across government, but there's a determination across society as well that we take action, but in a way that is, you know, appropriate and measurable, and that brings people with us. And okay. I think there are huge opportunities here, as have been outlined, to create new jobs and to grow businesses
and
too.
And to achieve that, the reduction target of 51%, will all of the actions outlined have to be implemented?
You know, they will in that...
Okay. Now, where will the money come from to implement all of those actions? Because the price tag in the Irish Times today to implement all of those actions is 125 billion euro.
Yes, so if you look at our national development plan of 165 billion euro is investing in all of our measures, and really what this is about is making sure that any investment we make as a state into the future, whether it's as we build new schools or different buildings, that it is done with our climate obligations to the forefront of our mind as well, that it's done in the most climate friendly way and the most efficient way, and helps us reach the targets that we need to reach.
Hang on a second, because 165 billion euro from the national development plan that you mentioned, some of that is carbon emission heavy. Now, the Irish Times figure of 125 billion euro, that's to reduce carbon emissions. Where will that money come from?
So, well, like, there are measures. If you take the area of agriculture, if you talk about funding, like obviously we have the new cap, and we just announced our co-financing of the agriculture measures in recent weeks. But all of the measures that we have in there is about supporting farmers in their changes. So if you take the specific examples where there are some interventions that farmers will have to do that will cost money, like a straw incorporation, chopping straw and putting it back into the ground, and where that costs money, the state will step in and support that enterprise and support farmers to do that 10 million a year. Every year, whereas there are other measures, and I'm making examples on agriculture because obviously it's the area I'm most familiar with in my department, but there are other measures that by supporting farmers and encouraging them to move into early slaughter dates for animals, to reducing the use of artificial fertilisers, that will actually reduce their input costs and in some ways will improve the incomes of farmers and has the potential to do that. So there are opportunities here and there are job opportunities, new employment opportunities that will be revenue raising. Amount of that 120, but to answer your question on the 125 billion, the large amount of that, largest amount of that money will come from private industry as well.
Oh, it will? So it'll be me and other listeners who will have to fork out of our own funds to make this happen.
No, because it's like private industry has all of its challenges to meet through Scope 3 and many other measures. And already we see industry across the board making decisions that are of this mind. So that 125 billion figure, you know, includes a lot of the investment that will happen in the space from private industry.
Okay, but so that includes private industry. It includes also listeners who may want to retrofit their home if they're lucky enough to have the funds to do so. That encompasses or includes is included in the 125 billion euro figure, you say as well. Can I ask you, since you mentioned agriculture, how is it that agriculture, one of the sectors with the highest emitting figures in terms of carbon emissions and methane emissions in the country, end up with one of the lowest targets?
So the targets for agriculture are ambitious and they are challenging. But, you know, rather than crude measures like herd reductions, what we're asking farmers to do is take a series of measures that are based on science and changes their management practices to ensure that we continue to produce great food, which we do, some of the most sustainable food in the world, but that we do that by driving down our emissions and do it even more sustainably into the future.
But you say it's ambitious. I mean, it's 20%, isn't it?
Target of 22 to 30%,
and energy is up to 80%. I mean, how did agriculture get? I mean, they won't like me for saying this, but let me be devil's advocate for a second. How did they get away with 20% when energy is hit with 80% of a reduction?
So obviously, in the approach we take, Cormac, I said at the start about us having a practical, sensible approach here, recognizing the fact that, you know, we proudly produce food that feeds 9 to 10 times our population size, and we do that more efficiently than most other countries in the world, and that is of huge economic value to our farm families, but to the rural communities that in which they live all over rural Ireland. So the approach we are taking here is to support farmers in that transition, and from a market perspective it makes sense as well. I'm just back from Glasgow, having spent a few days over meeting companies who buy and sell Irish food, and it's very clear for the high value markets that we want to grow our market share in terms of my role as new market development in the Department of Agriculture. The space there is all about the sustainability and the improving sustainability of our food produce. So to improve farmers' incomes, that's what we need to do. But this is a really challenging figures.
But they'll have to change farming practices though, won't they?
Absolutely. And in all the other measures you talk about, Cormac, for people's lives, you're talking about impacting on their lifestyle. With farmers, you're talking about their livelihood. And that is
And you're afraid to grasp that nettle in a way, aren't you? That's why
absolutely
you're not. What does managing the total herd number mean then? Is it a reduction?
It's stabilisation, as we have set out in our roadmap, and I'm very proud of the fact that my department in agriculture was the very first department to set out our roadmap called
Ag Climate Stabilisation.
So stabilisation means that the herd doesn't increase in size but doesn't reduce in size. So we're not going to take a crude measure like herd reduction because we're proud of the fact that we produce some of the best, most sustainable food in the world, but we know we need to do that better and even more efficiently into the future.
So how do you reduce methane then?
Oh, you reduce methane methane is one element of our measures. But if you look at, you know, the low emission slurry spreading practices, reducing in the area of reducing the use of artificial fertilisers, earlier slaughter dates is obviously a key area as well, and supporting farmers in that, improving the breeding and the genetics and the feeding of our animals.
And how can farmers do that? Farmers have the expertise to do that at the moment?
They do, and we have all of the science-based approach there. And Chagas, you know, around the country, and I also have responsibility in the area of research and innovation in the department. You know, Chagas, we have given increased funding to this year, over 156 million euro, but Chagas have over 100 signpost farms all over the country that are implementing these practices that we outlined in the Ag Climatised document that we published last year, the 29 individual actions that will get us a long way down the road. But these
A long way down the road. Isn't it the truth that you're relying on science-based approaches to try and reduce methane emissions with the total number of cattle that you have, because you're afraid to take on the farmers in this one?
Absolutely not, but science is still evolving, Cormac, and in the area of future gains, we will get future gains in the area of feed additives for methane. So if you take methane as an example, already the science has produced, and research and innovation investment has produced feed additives that reduce the methane emissions from livestock.
Okay, we'll see how that goes.
Can
I ask you about energy and what the plan says about reducing emissions in energy? You look at a review of Ireland's data centre strategy. Now, what does that mean?
So it's to make sure that our data centres in the future contribute in terms of offsetting the carbon and the energy impact that they have. But it's also being mindful that, we identify the level of which they use the challenges that brings, and that they can offset that by increased investments and, maybe increase requests on them in terms of conditions around planning.
Do you mean these huge energy guzzling data centres? I mean, 25% of the energy they're sucking out of the grid, or will be quite soon. Will they reduce? I mean, this is like asking about cattle. Will data centres, the numbers of them, reduce? We don't need all the data centres we have in this country, do we?
Look, the solution here is to make sure that data centres are given approval that have backup generation capabilities and have long duration batteries, so they don't use the power when the grid is under pressure. And we also need to look at where they're located. So, we are looking at probably similar to the national herd. There's an easy, lazy narrative at times that the media like to cut onto, to cut the herd, to block data centres, and that's just simple.
No, whereas that's based on what some experts say. It's not lazy.
The data centre policy is being reviewed, Cormac, but as I said before, we'll have a new policy in the early part of next year, but it is worth noting that data centres are increasingly being powered by renewables, with companies helping to finance that. And the point I made earlier about companies financing this, the European and worldwide law is coming down the line, and in terms of scope 3 and what would be requested of industry, is industry can't afford now to have elements of their business that are high emitting. So we have industry investing huge amounts of money in research and innovation as well to come up with solutions to reduce the carbon impact of these activities as well. And we will partner and work with industry in that area.
Can I ask you about what you're asking ordinary citizens who get up early in the morning and go into work and commute to work long distances sometimes? You're asking them, you're saying that in this plan, 500,000 daily journeys, you want them to be made by walking, cycling or public transport now. You want people to get out of cars. Let me read you one text from a listener. On public transport, it takes me 120 minutes to do a 20-minute journey to work in Dublin. Sort this out. It's a joke. Another listener says, I have a 110-kilometre round trip Monday to Friday from rural County Clare to work in UHL. There is no public transport that will accommodate the hours I work. And funnily enough, I have no text from any listener on the train to Donegal, because it doesn't exist. I mean, is this realistic at all?
Well, it is realistic if you look at the level of funding and finance that is earmarked in the area of transport, 35 billion between now and 2030. But Cormac, there is no element of this plan that is easy. There is no element of society that will escape having to change, and we don't like having to change our measures, but what we have to do here is get that balance right as a government, where we show that leadership and where we try and make sure that the changes are sensible, are practical, but we all know that no citizen will thank us if we sit back and don't face the challenge, which is the challenge of our lifetime.
Okay, in a word, should the Dáil car park go?
The Dáil car park is, there's plenty of green area around the Dáil as well. Yeah, look, I don't mind if it does or not.
Should it?
What's the Dáil car park got to do with anything? It's there. Look,
We better go ourselves. Look, Minister Martin Hayden of Fine Gael, thank you very much indeed.
Drive Time on RTÉ Radio 1 with Sarah McInerney and Cormac O'Hara.
Now, let's get some more political response to the publication this afternoon of the Climate Action Plan. I see Jennifer Whitmore of the Social Democrats welcoming the plan's ambition this evening, but saying it lacks the financial firepower that would make it a success. That's the Social Democrats' view. We're going to hear now from another opposition party. Darren O'Rourke is a Sinn Féin spokesperson on climate action. He's in our Leinster House studio this evening. Darren, you're very welcome to Drive Time.
Thanks, Cormac.
You're still working your way through this document, I assume, like the rest of it. What's your initial reaction?
Well, I think, it was a really important day in the timeline of our response to the climate crisis, which is real, and we need states to lead in our response to the climate crisis. And unfortunately, on initial appraisal of the document, I think it's very disappointing. There's a lot in it, a huge amount of action points, very similar to the 2019 version. There's 70-odd mentions of reviews. There's 70-odd mentions of strategies. That's probably not surprising given the fact that, you know, these are three parties that have been here before and that have failed to deliver on any of their previous commitments in terms of climate. And I think a fundamental part
of that...
Hang
on a second now. What are you disappointed with? Because we're getting closer and closer, aren't we? And some would say environmental campaigners actually have said in this programme that they note a step change in recent months in relation to the Climate Action Plan. And we're getting closer, as Taoiseach said, to very specific targets in each sector. We have the ranges now. So what are you disappointed with?
No, there's absolutely been no shortage. And if that's a point of credit, it's not a great point of credit. There's no shortage of plans. We've had plans for literally a decade or certainly 7 or 8 years at this stage since back in 2015. We've had no shortage of targets.
What are you disappointed with?
Well, I'm disappointed. Actually, the fundamental basis of the plan, the deliverability of it, the likelihood of it being delivered.
What specifically?
The funding for it is the principal weakness I would see, Cormac. You can see there. Well, there's 125 billion euros that is essentially going to be burdened on already struggling workers and families right across this state. So families that are in debt at the minute, that are struggling with household bills over this winter, are faced with the prospect of now carrying the additional burden of delivering on the government's and our collective climate objectives.
Well, I don't understand what you mean, because that's not all of that is not taxation, and it won't be imposed on people.
No, but the expectation is that as part of this transition, that 125 billion euros will be made out of the spending of individual workers and families. So if my argument is that the state needs to lead in relation to this, it needs to. And the Taoiseach has said that people need to be convinced. I don't believe that people need to be convinced. They need to be supported in this transition.
And they will be through grants, for example. Let me take up. I don't fully understand what you mean by the financing of it that you're disappointed. So let's take retrofitting, for example.
So let me make this point. So the state is committing 35 billion euros through the National Development Plan to transport, 12.9 billion euros towards climate, 9.5 billion euros in a carbon tax that actually I think should be questioned, because there are proposals there at a European level to siphon off some of that, up to 80% of it. In addition to that, even if that didn't happen, the carbon tax should be a diminishing return if it's to be successful at all. It should be the victim of its own success.
Hang on a second. You're critical of the carbon tax, but all the increases in carbon tax receipts, amounting, they say, to 9.5 billion euro out to 2030, they're earmarked, they're ring-fenced for targeted social protection measures, like an expansion of retrofitting, for example, for social and low-income homes. What's wrong with that?
So first of all, there is a fundamental question. I raised it with the minister today. I raised it with the junior minister in the Dáil this morning. There is a serious question mark over whether that funding will be delivered over the decade, because of moves at a European level in the Fit for 55, but also in terms of they're calculating it on a linear basis, and it should be a diminishing return if people are moving away from carbon. So there's a question mark that Sinn Féin and I am putting in beside that 9.5 billion euros. But the point is, Cormac, to go back to it, 35 billion euros plus 12.9 billion euros plus, if they achieve it, 9.5 billion euros falls a long, long way short of what is going to be required. So the state is not doing its fair share of lifting in relation to this.
So what is the biggest thing that should be done that isn't in this plan?
And taxpayers, workers and families who are struggling at the minute are expected. And I just believe that leaves this whole plan not credible.
Okay, that is quite a clear position from you. So you might tell us then, what is the biggest action that isn't in this plan that should be?
So we need a formal basis for the government to raise their responsibility, their role in relation to it, to target those areas that, you know, need a just and fair transition, to ensure that those people who are struggling, who want, and I believe people in Ireland are putting their hand up that they don't need to be convinced.
Sorry, you're saying this falls short. Give me a concrete action that isn't in the plan that should be.
So Sinn Féin, for example, present an alternative budget every year, and we did the same this year in terms of how we would raise revenue, for example, to deliver on a fair plan. But you could go through it line by line, Cormac, if you want. Like, for example, the ambition in terms of many of the areas in agriculture or in offshore wind or onshore wind or the area...
What,
like,
in agriculture?
Well, for example, the ambition in terms of organics, my colleague Matt Carty has repeatedly said it. Like, it falls short in terms of
it's a fivefold increase in organic farming.
It falls short, not only in what it should be, but also in terms of where the European Union is in terms of their targets.
I ask you then? This plan announced today, it's to be back-ended, I think, in some of the actions, which could mean that by the time we get to implementing those actions, that Sinn Féin could be in power. So will you give a commitment to people, given that the UN Secretary General said at COP26 this week that we are careening towards catastrophe from a climate change perspective, will you give a commitment to listeners now that you will implement the actions in this plan?
Sinn Féin is committed to delivering on the targets, and actually, to make the point, Cormac, we were one of the parties to argue for interim targets, the 2030 targets.
Will you implement these actions?
Government? We will strive to achieve those targets.
Will you implement the actions outlined quickly?
Very many of the actions that are included. There is no controversy in terms of offshore wind. There's no controversy in terms of onshore wind. There's no controversy in terms of the need to move to active travel. There's no controversy in terms of the move to electric vehicles. We want to see that, and we want to see it happen more quickly. But the problem with the government's approach is that they're not supporting people in that transition. Okay. In fact, they're leaving them behind.
Okay. And we'll take that up with you when we have a little bit more time, I promise, and tease it out a little bit more. But for the moment, can I thank you for your contribution, Darren O'Rourke of Sinn Féin.